to achieve those goals, we dreamed up this massive research project, which would keep these fellows so busy that they couldn't bother anybody. As it turned out, it was an enormously successful project. The first time in any governmental agency that a target approach was taken towards a Soviet target. I should say a systems approach was taken towards a Soviet target.
Do you want to explain that a little bit?
Yes. We wanted to pull together all information from whatever source, of whatever degree of reliability, and collate that information in terms of its geographical location. And from that effort, a series of natural targets sprang up, which could be looked upon as solid Soviet rocket and nuclear facilities. We were not entirely without sources. We had an enormously valuable source from the so-called first chief director of the NKVD, and predecessor to the KGB. Which pinpointed both the rocket work in the USSR and the nuclear work. The first chief director was the director, basically it was the Soviet Atomic Energy Commission, which I have to go back. I mean, part of my willingness to go through this some X number of years later is the fact that I'll be quite frank, it's a matter of vanity.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that I, as well as a number of other people, never got really recognition for some of the things we did,
mm-hmm.
Compared to various people who did get recognition. It's not that we were in the business for fame and glory, we were not. But while I was in the OCI, and on this became USSR, branch chief before I made the London trip. I was the only voice in the British-American foreign policy complex that accurately predicted the political demise of Georgi Mylenkov in the USSR and the rise of Khrushchev. I just throw that in. The reason that we kind of come back around to this guided missile study in the on the USSR for the, as I say, the first time ever, we took a systems approach to the Soviet target. When we say systems approach, we mean to start at the beginning of a weapon system, on through its R&D, its serial production, its introduction to the forces, and its deployment. It's the first time ever that had been undertaken.
This being an enemy weapon system.
An enemy weapon system.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. And you managed to do this through a source who was placed in the...
No, I managed to do this through this research project with these two guys from the DDI.
Okay.
I mentioned that source. When I mentioned that source, Icarus, I simply mentioned him that, in fact, we did have some good information as to what had gone on in the USSR and what some of the likely places and so forth were.
Okay.
We also had a flow of, particularly after Sputnik, we had a flow of German repatriated German scientists from the USSR.
Who brought the information which these two men compiled?
Who brought information of their own work, their own missile work.
Okay.
and their own identification of localities and logistics and this and that and the next thing. No, the two DDI researchers, they were simply coordinators over in the DDI for all of this work being brought together.
Okay.
So the thing was a smashing success. But for the first time, there was a complete overview of everything known about the USSR nuclear and missile development systems. And all of the officers engaged in the research expressed appreciation for having been compelled, if you will, to do this basic scut work, which they should have been doing all along and had not done. British, once again, call this the best single achievement of American research since the war.
Did it have a title to the project?
No title. It was, let's see, election planning guide. Election planning guide for Soviet ICBM system. Something like that was the title of the published report.
And has it been a model for future reports?
Yes, it was for a number of years, but the things do get lost over time. And yes, it was a model. I say the British looked at it. They thought it was the greatest thing done in the field yet, and which was gratifying. They sent communication back to that effect. In any event, that was the sum total of my work at that time. It was at that time that an opportunity came up for a posting to Tehran, which I seized.
And the date on that?
We left for Tehran, I think it was the 14th of December, 1960.
You and your family?
I and my family, yes. And we spent the next 4 years, actually until July, August 1965, 64. In terror. I ran into some career obstacles at this time, primarily of my own making, and did not receive a favorable assignment when I came back to the United States in 1964.
Can we go into the Tehran tour just a little bit superficially?
Well, it was simply that we ran, I was in charge of positive intelligence, the agent operations against the USSR based in Iran.
Okay.
Of a variety of types. Legal travelers, illegals, diplomatic, communications, and so on.
Okay. So you were actually a case officer?
No, I was a branch chief.
Okay.
And then I was not branch chief, group chief at first. Soviet operations, then branch chief on the Soviet bloc branch, which embraced both positive intelligence operations, but also counter-espionage against the Soviets in Iran.
Which is detecting who the Soviet agents were in their embassy or
that's right,
whatever.
Exactly.
Okay.
Okay. So I ran that for 4 years, almost 4 years.
Can you tell me what the nature was of the obstacles So then they, as far as your career was concerned?
Let's just use the one word, insubordination.
Insubordination, okay.
To Washington. Not the first time, not the last. Except this time I did not get voted.
Was it an individual or just the bureaucracy itself?
No, it was primarily an individual. My predecessor in the chairman was okay. Second guessing.
Okay.
Our decisions and recommendations all the time. Washington, I was assigned to Sino-Soviet relations, which meant covert action, which means black propaganda. And so undertook a number of operations which were designed to keep friction going between the Chinese and the Soviets.
Can you describe one?
Off the record.
Okay.
So-called false flag recruitment, attempted false flag, false flag attempted recruitment of Chinese diplomats by Soviet intelligence operations.
Tom, is this then that somebody poses as a Soviet?
Somebody poses as a Soviet. And you use legitimate Soviet cipher systems, and legitimate, pure Soviet methodology throughout. Okay, back on the record.
And sounds like real cloak and dagger stuff.
Lots of room for imagination. And we've had some pretty guys in the agency. We really have.
Well, this is one of the things, if you could talk to,
I mentioned earlier the laser audio operation.
Right, okay.
The camcorders, the today's video camera, they use what they call charge couple device.
Okay.
With cascade discharge.
Cascade discharge?
Discharge, yeah. That, off the record, that was developed by the agency 20 years ago for the optical systems for the satellites. Back on the record. As I say, brilliant thing. Okay, you're getting a little bit more of an introduction to it. Maybe you've been into some of these things already.
Well, I've read Victor Marchetti's books. And
more importantly, did you ever read Wilderness of Mirrors?
No, but that's a book I can't find anywhere.
Oh, I see.
Have had it on a little piece of paper tacked to my bulletin board for over 2 years.
Yeah, okay, I can find it on the paper.
Okay.
It's one of the few books I've kept. Became interested in the Vietnam War, which at that time, we're now in 1965.
Were you operating incidentally out of Washington in the Sino-Soviet?
The Sino-Soviet Air Force headquarters.
Okay.
Became interested in the Vietnamese thing because it was a part of my job at this time. And the whole situation was so confusing that I had this urge from time to time to go over there and find out what really was going on. So Johnson sends in the troops and the thing becomes serious. In the meantime, I had told my division chief when I came back, okay, I'll take this job and I'll do my best, but I do want reassignment overseas as soon as possible. And in about a year's time, after you've satisfied yourself that I'm okay for this, I'll come in and ask you about an overseas assignment. So it was in the summer of 65, I went in and I said, I'm interested in overseas assignment. I'm not asking to go overseas this minute or next month or 6 months. All I want is a statement from you that when a suitable opportunity comes up, that yes, I will be considered for that assignment. And division chief says, I can't, I won't make that commitment.
Was that William Colby?
No, that was Dave Murphy.
This different division then?
No, Soviet division.
Soviet division, right.
No. Colby was always FE.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It would seem to me that there would have to be a consent between the two division chiefs to share a person or...
Well, no, I'm not shared with anybody at this stage.
I see. So you would go to Saigon as part of the...
No, I'm not in Saigon yet.
But
I'm asking my division chief, Soviet division, to get for another chance to go overseas.
Okay.
And he's saying, no, I won't give you that kind of commitment.
Okay.
And so since I've been working on the Vietnamese problem, I knew that the agency had a call out for Vietnamese officers, and that anybody who volunteered to go to Vietnam would go, period. That they could not be held back by their parent divisions.
Okay,
I volunteered for Vietnam.
What was your introduction to getting involved in the Vietnamese affairs? How did that come about?
My work in Sino-Soviet affairs, mm-hmm. and in the Far East generally, local problems between the Russians and the Chinese in the Far East.
Because they're having a big conflict over how to handle Vietnam themselves.
Well, there's the Vietnam problem, but there's also the fact that Vietnam looks like an interesting problem. I mean, totally aside from any... I mean, you couldn't miss it in the newspapers and magazines.
Right, okay.
So I volunteered for Vietnam and went over there and... this was September. May have been October.
As? And you're...
I went over to be the chief of field operations.
Okay. Now, were you given a small briefing of what that job would entail before you went over?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I had long conversations with the Vietnamese guests and with the people who come back from Vietnam.
Okay.
And with studied up on Oriental philosophy and Oriental religions and psychology and so on.
Well, how much, could you tell me history, how much preparation that you had?
As much as I could get.
Yeah.
Well, I was like a vacuum cleaner.
I was, okay.
Bernard Fall's two books, or perhaps... most very, very significant.
Street Without Joy.
Street Without Joy, and there was another one. And there was I think The Lost Command was one of those books in that period. Going back to the end of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you've got to understand, throughout all these years, a person is exposed to all of this stuff. For example, during the French Indochina War, mm-hmm. 10, 12 years previous to this that we're talking about, we read all the cable traffic dealing with Dien Bien Phu, for example.
Okay.
And all of this business about use of American nuclear weapons in Indochina,
mm-hmm.
and how the French were so angered by us when the chips were down, and we said no way.
Because there were agency people flying planes in and out of Dien Bien Phu.
Not agency people. Those are Joint Chiefs of Staff we're talking about. These are commitments made by the French government.
Okay.
Or what the French government believed to be commitments of the American
from government. The Joint Chiefs of Staff.
From the Department of State, President,
yep.
whatever.
Okay.
I don't care.
Yeah.
This is all State Department traffic, military traffic. The CIA, we just don't read our own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We get all this traffic from the
right. Because you're essentially an intelligence agency.
Yeah.
Right.
And so you're on top of just about anything that goes on. So even at that time, in 1965, mm-hmm. Vietnam was not a new point of interest.
Right, I understand. Yeah. Okay.
So anyway, Street Without Joy and Lost Command, with various novels, the history books, and so on.
What about, incidentally, Graham Greene? Did you read
inasmuch as I read everything Graham Greene had written, The Ancestry, yes. So went over to Vietnam as chief field operation. I was not directly, but when the guy I was replacing left, I became chief of field operation. That was Tucker Ulum.
Okay.
The only man, only CIA officer, to my knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Body was returned to us by the North Vietnamese
in
1976.
Because he was captured in 75 in
April. In 75 in the Imperial Hotel in South Africa. And they killed him.
After quite some time, I understand.
Well, after the torture, that's all it was.
Yeah.
I mean, they were trying to force him. I'm sure.
Yeah.
No time.
Yeah, I've heard some stories about him.
He's one of the legends of the agency. Anyway, he was my boss, my first.
Okay, so you were his deputy?
I was his deputy, and then I replaced him when he came. Well, actually, when he went over to New Delhi, he didn't come home.
Okay.
And he and I remained friends. So then it was in that capacity that I stayed through with June of 1967. Came home, assigned to SAVA, which was George Carver's staff, Special Assistant for Vietnam Affairs, to the DCI.
Yep.
There, 2 months, went back out to Vietnam to work with Ed Parker, who is now on site as the first director for the ISAC staff. Then came back in October or November, I forget. My brother-in-law had a second heart attack and I had to leave Saigon early. Remained with SAVA until the end of the year, at which time about the end of the year, at which time I returned to the Soviet division.
I just called George Carver about 2 weeks ago, and he had just gone into the hospital.
Yeah.
And they said, well, his family, his sounded like a daughter, wouldn't say what the problem was. I didn't ask. I just said, is it serious? And she was in tears.
Yeah.
So I understand that. And I said, well, should I call back later? And they said, there was no answer. I said, well, maybe a month or two. And they said maybe a month or two, so I had the feeling it was very serious.
He's a pudgy little man. And it could very easily, it probably always had high blood pressure.
Yeah.
Very easily.
There was no question in my mind that there was something serious that had come up quickly without warning.
Oh, he was on TV not too long ago.
Yeah,
He's, I think, affiliated with Georgetown now.
Yeah.
And Georgetown, whatever they call it over there, and the Strategic Studies Institute over there. And so they drag him out, TV people drag him out from time to time to comment
mm-hmm.
about things like that.
And he was the SAVA?
He was SAVA.
Which is Special Assistant?
Assistant for Vietnam Affairs.
Yeah, okay.
Now this was up at the DCI level.
Okay.
And sort of a coordinating point for all agency and indeed even interagency activities relating to Vietnam. George himself was a Yalie also. PhD. And had written this famous foreign affairs article on Vietnam. It's I don't recall the date or anything, but it was very instrumental in forming U.S. policy. And as a matter of fact, the intellectual rationale for U.S. intervention in Vietnam. It was while on the SAVA staff that we went through the Khe Sanh period. And shortly after that, after I returned to the Soviet bloc division, that there was the Tet Offensive in 1968, January. What was that, 27th of January? Do you remember the date?
That sounds pretty good to me.
Because that's
it stopped. It's 27. Yeah, it started in different days in different places. Some people say Tet started with Khe Sanh.
Yeah. Well, no, it didn't. Because Khe Sanh, we'll get to that in a little while.
Okay.
This whole Khe Sanh episode, I think, is fascinating.
Yeah.
So then, Soviet operations from then until, we're at 60. 58. 1970, I guess, I became chief of plans for Soviet division.
It sounds like that was a good career move.
Yes. And in 1972, moved to the plans and program staff of the DCI, the executive service.
Which means?
Changing career designation from the operations director to the executive service.
More like a staff level position.
It's a personnel classification.
Okay. Thing. Overall management. Rather than in a pro,
it's agency level.
Yeah,
plans, programs, and budget. PPB, plans, programs, and budget. And up there, I was in the planning branch of the agency of the PPB, which was the planning unit for the director for the agency.
And so that's all strategic planning, I suppose.
Well, strategic planning. Also, I got very deeply involved in management planning.
Uh-huh. Okay.
We brought in some low-key, we hoped, management by objectives. We brought in a number of management reforms. I brought in capital budgeting techniques, long-range planning.
Management
by objective.
By objective, okay.
Yeah.
Plus, my wife's an MBA, so I hear her talk about things like that.
It's passé now, but at that time it was not yet on its up.
Mm-hmm.
I got into that at the very beginning. So,
mm-hmm.
So stemming partly once again from the Vietnam experience.
Lesson learned.
Yeah. So then I retired and June of 74, I went to work for a consulting corporation for 2 years.
Did you do consulting for the CIA?
No. Yeah, I did a little, but not much. I was in contract. But the corporation had basically nothing to do with the CIA.
Was it security affairs?
No, it was management consulting, leadership systems. But I decided that although the money in consulting is very good, life is too short.
Mm-hmm.
That is a rat race.
Mm-hmm. It's the rat race everybody wants to be in, too.
Well, I was not prepared to retire from the agency, turn around, jump from the front end into the fire. That's what it added up to.
Yep.
So I stopped that, went to American University to get a master's degree in religious studies. And everybody always raises their eyebrows about why religion of all things? Well, you stop to think about it. Religion is a study of man's deepest goals and aspirations and value systems.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, political studies and study of international relations, for example, and study of history is relatively meaningless without consideration of this.
From as a person who's always studied literature, mm-hmm. I didn't truly come to understand myself as a writer until I took a course in classical myth and the Bible.
Yeah.
And we read the Bible, and then I came to understand what archetypes really were, and how as a writer I could reach into somebody mm-hmm. and touch the archetypes and evoke the response that mm-hmm. I wanted when I was writing.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So it works on that level too, in terms of just communicating with people and getting a message across.
It actually started with me in something the same way. The fact that a senior last term at Yale, I had to